to Lisa Hsu, and I think Danielle, are you going to tee this one up?
So, yeah, the second topic, and I'll try and be very brief because I know that we're running a little bit behind on time, but we're going to have two topics, one first on lessee and then also on lessor, but I know that they are very much interrelated. And when we talked to the boards last week in an education session, we brought to them a paper that talked about types of leases and whether there would be different approaches both from the lessee side and the lessor side. In that paper, also, we talked through just the targeted outreach, and just to reiterate a little bit about that, I know all of you participated in our targeted outreach, but we also talked to preparers, users, some standard setters, and the accounting firms, across geographies, lessee, lessor, and a number of different industries. And so the conclusions from that feedback were a number of the preparers, the majority, were very supportive of the boards pursuing two different approaches for lessee and lessor accounting. And I'd say they predominantly focus on the lessee side of things. Users, for the most part, again, we're looking at the economics of the transactions and trying to get to cash flows that occurred during the transaction, so matching more so the P&L impacts with the cash or the cash flows of that transaction. So a number we're supportive of moving to two different approaches for this accounting. And so on page three of the agenda topic, really the targeted outreach, and then I probably might just want to open it up to the room and get feedback on there was a paper that we presented, and the staff's view at this point is that we do believe that there are two different types of leases or two different approaches that may be followed for lessee accounting, and that would be the topic. And then the second phase of that was then there's some indicators, and when we talked with you in the targeted outreach, we talked about whether IS 17 could be used for the split or whether a new set of indicators, and again, the indicators that we put forward both had a risks and rewards concept as well as a business model concept or principle embedded in them, and would like to get the views of if we move down a path that there are two different approaches, what should be kind of the overriding indicators that would make that cut? Does 17 do that correctly? Does the staff's view, including some type of a business model or an evaluation of the business transaction, is that an important key component in making that split? And again, the staff's view is that those indicators or whatever we're going to use should be used on both sides of the transaction, both for lessees and for lessors. And if there's views on, does that make sense? We'd be happy to listen to those. And I'm sure the board themselves may have additional questions that might want to be asked of the group. So with that, if there's somebody that wants to kick us off.
Okay. Thanks, Kristen.
Sure.
What reactions?
Nope. I've been listening to some of the board meetings, and there was a suggestion made by Leslie Seidman that maybe we just use straight-line P&L for all leases. And I think what you could say in that case, I guess I don't like the terminology that's being used now, but I'd suggest that we say that there are leases that are financing leases, and then there are leases that are rentals. And I think at a previous ISB board meeting, one of the ISB board members said, just look at the residual. If I look at a lease and I see there's an automatic transfer of title, that means that the lessee gets the asset. If I look at a lease and see there's a bargain purchase option, the lessee gets the asset. Those are financing. Then I could look at things like, does the lessee guarantee the residual? Does the lessee get the upside when the asset is sold? Then I might say those are financings. But a simple way of looking at it is to say everything else is a rental, because regardless of whether I'm leasing it for substantially all of its useful life or if I'm paying substantially all of the cost of the asset, in the end I give it back to the lessor. And so that could be a simple view, and I think that takes into account what Rich's question was regarding leasing equipment like shipping containers that are interchangeable, and I might initially be leasing one that's brand new and another one that's 14 years old and it only has one more year life. If in the end, at the end of the day I give that back, then that's just a rental and I should be just using straight line P&L. I also know, I've listened to all of the meetings and Larry keeps pointing out the fact that we have a problem in trying to look at the at leases, because there is a spectrum. We have leases that look and act and smell like financings, and then we have some that are obviously rentals. And when we try to either draw a line, I don't know, that's not a good word, but when we try to figure out where a lease is, like in the old school of thinking, where it in fact or in effect transfers the underlying, we're getting back to the old way of thinking of things. But just kind of to throw it out there, maybe we just look at contracts that say that they're either financing leases or they're rentals. And if they're financing, they're accounted for just like I own the equipment. I depreciate it over its economic useful life. I account for the obligation as though it were an interest-bearing obligation. But otherwise, if they're rentals, it's a question of cost allocation, and it seems to make the most amount of sense to have the same cost in every period of that lease when I'm just paying for the right of use. I also realize that we board meetings have talked about the fact that leases are executory contracts, but the lessor has delivered, and that justifies capitalization. But on the lessee side, they really have to pay rent every month, and so you could look at it as the concept of them paying for the use, otherwise they give up the right to use the equipment. So that indicates maybe it's a periodic expense.
Don turned off. I wanted to ask a question. So are you saying in terms of the criteria that we've been discussing that maybe we're over-engineering it and you need to be just take a very simple approach? Are you really getting all of the benefits of this asset in one way or another as a lessee?
Yeah, I don't know what the right answer is. It's a difficult topic, of course. But that gives you simplicity and gives you a cut. If you know that the equipment is going back to the lessor and that there's no guarantee of the residual, maybe you can just call those rental contracts, regardless of the length of the lease or the amount that's paid. It's simple. Whether it's right or not, as Larry's talked many times, we have a hard time trying to figure out anything else. We're always going to have a hard time trying to figure out anything else.
Thanks, Bill. David?
I think that the part of the problem with classification is the fact you've got classification and just having a large number of indicators is not going to solve some of the problems we have at the moment. And I think one of the problems with the proposal at the moment, there isn't a clear principle of what is a financing and what isn't. So you can have indicators. What do you judge those indicators against? Particularly if you then start having risk and rewards and a business model, what are those conflict? Which one takes priority? How do you decide whether someone who is business model is pricing it as a financing but taking significant risk from a lessor's point of view, is that a financing or not? How does one weigh up those two principles and decide which one overrides the other one? And the other issue, we talk about bright lines. At some stage, the auditor's going to have to say where that bright line is. You can identify, yes, there is asset risk being taken by the lessor, but is it sufficient or is it totally insignificant? And I would bet you, regardless of whether you include a 90% test or an equivalent in here, once this is applied, people will be applying the equivalent to a 90% test because at some stage, a lessor has got to decide where that bright line is going to be. So an auditor's got to decide where that bright line is going to be drawn. If you have a lease that you say, yes, this is not a financing, and assuming if they want it to be not a financing, obviously there's a question of which side of the line people are structuring it for anyway. But people will then amend it, keep on moving further and further to one direction, at which point the auditor's got to say, no, you've now crossed that line. And how do you do that if you haven't got a 90% test?
So where do you come out on this thing? You've told us about all the problems.
I think you stick with what you've got at the moment, which everyone understands, or one doesn't have a classification at all. One treats all the leases the same.
But when you say where we are at the moment, the exposure direct approach?
No, I mean under I-17.
Oh, okay.
The
so classification you agree that we should try and distinguish for a finance and that's...
No, my personal view is we should have one accounting for all leases without a distinguishing. But if we have to distinguish, I think we should stick with the current I-17.
Okay. Well, let me just keep going around the table. Kevin?
Kristen, maybe I misheard when you were talking about the indicators. Were you concluding that you can have, if the indicators tell you you've got a lessor finance lease, they would automatically indicate you've got a lessee finance lease? Are we looking for symmetry again?
No.
As I say, because I used that tugboat example, and at initial recognition in 1D, initial recognition, the guy who's got the coal is ambivalent as to which tugboats are used, and would therefore be on this service contract. But the owner of the tugboats might, on initial recognition, be saying, well, that solves those three tugboats for the next 20 years. The example in 1D uses an awful lot of hindsight, which occurs over 2 or 3 years, to come back to initial recognition accounting. Because the example in 1D talks about, well, they were interchanged. And you don't know that on day one. And I just sort of wonder where we get to, because I can get to day one on that 1D and have a lessor finance lease, and as a result of interchangeability occurring 2 or 3 years later, maybe he hasn't. And we still haven't got to that page either.
You're on.
Okay. From a symmetrical perspective, what the staff's recommendation is that you would use the same set of things to make a distinction, which many times may get the same answer, but perhaps will not, based on the lessor may have other residual value guarantees outside the arrangement between the lessee and the lessor, and just an evaluation of the facts that both would go through. But the intent was that you use the same thing to evaluate, not necessarily the end result will always be the same. That was the staff's recommendation. And maybe can I just say one other thing related to the indicators? What the staff also thought was very important is in 17, there's a principle that defines a finance lease, and there's also a principle for the operating lease, but it's really just the inverse of the finance lease. And so what one concept that we thought was very important was to truly define, if we have two different things, define the two different things, not just as the inverse of the other. And so that was another part of the new indicators and principle that we had laid out as an improvement, we hoped.
Thank you. Paul? I wanted to ask Bill and David and maybe others about the idea of a nice, simple principle dividing the two types of leases, the finance and the rentals. And it's certainly appealing, possibly sticking with the IAS 17 criteria. But I assume you still would put even the rentals on the balance sheet. Or am I wrong? Both of you would. But then my question to you is, will the balance sheet, at least for the asset, become just a meaningless residual number? I assume we're going to try to get the debt right, initially measured at present value, and so we'll have interest expense, amortized effective interest method. And the only way you can then get the balance sheet right to have a straight line is really to have a number on the balance sheet that doesn't mean a lot to anybody. Is that part of your proposal also, or something different?
You're on.
Yeah, I'd like to say, what I think, all contracts where the lessee is obligated to pay rent, or whether they're financings or, in quotes, operating leases or rentals, the leases are on balance sheet for the lessee. How we get, now we're talking about mechanics of accounting for the expense or cost allocation on a straight line basis, I would advocate that the asset be amortized at the same rate the debt does, except for maybe initial direct costs. There might be some difference, but basically that's what I would say. I would like to also add one other comment, and I'd ask, are we accounting for the rights and obligations in the contract, or are we accounting for the underlying? And that's one of the problems that I see with creeping back into the realm of classification. I don't think it matters whether my residual is large or not as to whether or not I've transferred something of value and should be able to derecognize that. A one-year lease of an aircraft versus a 30-year lease of an aircraft should still get derecognition and profit recognition because I've transferred an asset as a bundle of rights. I've transferred a piece of that right. There's a basis in that. What I have left has diminished in value, and so I think we have to be thinking: are we talking about accounting for the rights and obligations, or are we talking about accounting for the underlying? Because that's not the basis. That's not what I understood the new regime to be.
I think it's for the rights and obligations, and for the record, I didn't ask Phil to say that before about derecognition. I didn't ask you to say that about derecognition. But I like what I heard. David, you want to come in too?
My personal view is no, it should not. The asset should not be the balancing number. I think, which is why I don't think there should be a difference in the accounting between for certain types of leases. I think one accounting should be used for all leases. But I do feel that consideration should be given to the annuity method of depreciation for all assets, not just for leased assets, because I think conceptually it is a valid approach. And if you apply the annuity depreciation and the financing element, you will end up with the straight line depreciation if the rentals are straight line. I think the other problem is just simply straight lining could produce some anomalies. If I prepay a lease, and supposing the asset cost is $1,000, and I prepay it, so I pay $1,000, do I just straight line $1,000 and have, supposing it's 10 years, have $100 per year? If, on the other hand, someone pays all the rentals at the back end and therefore pays, I don't know, $1,400, do they then straight line $1,400 and have, therefore, $140 charge per year? The difference between the two, obviously, is the interest charge. But should that be straight-lined? I don't think it should be. I think that this distorts the economics. So I think it should be a principles-based method of determining the depreciation of the asset based on the annuity method, and the financing should be treated as financing.
David, maybe I can just... I heard you talk before about the sort of mortgage-based amortization approach, and it's certainly one of the approaches that's in the staff paper, and I think is probably our preferred approach from the staff if the boards were to head this direction. How would you, you know, some of the questions we've had are looking into comparisons to how we deal with amortization depreciation in other literature at the moment and apply that guidance to other assets. How would you articulate that the mortgage-based amortization fits with the notion of sort of trying to consume the benefits of the asset on that pattern of benefits approach?
Under IAS 16, the amortization should reflect the element of the asset which is being consumed. And I would have said the best measure of what's being consumed in any period is the value of that asset at the beginning compared to the value of the asset at the end. And if you value the asset based on the present value of the future cash flows from that asset, then you will end up with a sort of annuity type or interest type basis of depreciation, because it would be the movement in the present value over that period would be the measure of what's being consumed. So I think it fits in with the IAS 16 definition of depreciation anyway. I don't think it needs a change to IAS 16. It just needs a change in interpretation and practice.
Is that true for real estate, what you just said?
Real estate is often measured on a measure of the future rental income.
But real estate often is going up in value. Or down.
Well, it's going up with inflation. I mean, that's...
In most cases, say, if you have your own asset, as your own asset, in that case, IS 16 should be applied. But say, in case of right of use asset, you just suggested the annuity method. So the...
What, no, I'm saying that it should apply the same method to both.
Okay, so in that
case, IS 16 doesn't say straight line anywhere. Yeah. It says it's it is a one but method.
Yeah, but in reality, I've never ever heard under IS 16, annuity method should be applied. But
no, because the accounting firms won't allow it.
So, one more question is: your suggestion of the annuity method is annuity method reflect the actual consumption of the service potentials, or just you would like to achieve the straight line recognition of gains and losses on the income statement?
No, I think both elements should be accounted for properly. You should account for the asset, but not using the annuity method. You should account for the financing element as a financing. And where you have straight line rentals, it will give you straight line net income. Where you've got uneven rentals, or front-ended or back-ended, it will not give you straight line. And nor should it.
Bill, did you want to come back?
I just wanted to add a little bit to what David said. If my rents are uneven, I, talking about the mechanics of getting to straight line rent, I would accrue the average rent. And then when I pay the rent, I would credit cash debit that accrual. And then I would use annuity depreciation on the asset, and I would impute interest on the liability. And if we debit and credit all of that to rent expense, we get the level rent. And we also recognize on the balance sheet, in the case of rent that's paid towards the end of the contract, we are accruing that liability by accruing the average rent.
Okay. Thank you. And Mark?
I think a lot of the points that I wanted to make have been made by David and Bill, and I agree with them entirely. I wanted to come back on, I think we're talking about this, two types of leases. I've been looking at a paper which is 1F, is more than one accounting approach necessary. I wanted to talk about that on the lessor side, because I'm very concerned by what I see in 3B, where there's a thing about the lessor having to perform throughout the lease term.
Mark, do you mind if we...
Is that later?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm on the wrong subject then.
Later.
That's fine.
So...
The only other point I wanted to say was to respond to Kevin's point on symmetry, that it's essential that if you use the same elements to look at to decide which type of lease it is, if indeed we have two types of lease, you've got to recognise that you don't necessarily get the same answer on lessor and lessee side. That is essential, otherwise it just won't work.
Just for my clarification, you said you agreed with Bill and David, but I heard David saying his preference is to stay where we are at the moment in the ED, that is, to treat them all the same. And I think he's saying if we go down this route, then you use...
David is saying that his preference would be to have... He thinks that the most logical position is to have one accounting model for leases, but it's the accounting model with the annuity-type depreciation of the assets. And I think he's saying he thinks that that should be allowed under IS 16 as well. And that would give you, as he explained quite clearly, a straight-line P&L.
Is that what
you... That I agree with, yeah.
And you would no longer need to distinguish between...
Okay, so that's your view.
Yeah, but it's... I think that... In a lot of what you hear in board discussions, it's either one method is the current one or two methods is the current one plus the annuity method. There are people saying one method is right, but it's the annuity method only. And yeah, but I would agree with that.
Okay. Thomas.
I'm not really happy with the to distinguish between two types of leases either. I don't think there are only two types. It's not like black and white. There are very big bunch of leases which are both rental, and they have rental elements and they have final elements, and for that reason I think it's always somehow arbitrary to distinguish between finance and operating. And that was one of the targets of the project at the very beginning, to come the difficulties which are connected with that distinguish. So now we are at the status where we decided, okay, let's put the leases on the balance sheet of the lessee, and we use the right of use approach for the balance sheet. Now, coming to the P&L statement, we think, okay, we might need to differentiate, and then we still need another principle. This is now more or less the old principle of risk and reward. I think it's very difficult, and I would very much refer to one model for the lessee, and I would be at the end maybe in favor, why don't we give the lessees an option to depreciate the asset either straight line or based on an annuity method. So both, based on the business model, both elements, the rental element and the financing element, could be reflected.
Okay. Mary, then?
Just a couple observations. I think I do agree with the concept that there is more than one type of lease, but I think the other issue for the board to consider whether you want to make some practical accommodations, right? So the one issue is the theoretical argument, and two, whether you want to go somewhere else, because the record keeping and the other elements would not necessarily justify the cost. So that's another avenue you may want to pursue, because I think this is some things that you're hearing beyond the full conceptual agreement that there could be, one type of lease. In this regard, going back to the notion of depreciation and how you depreciate, and the comment that was made by Paul about real estate, I think the issue is not in the leasing project. The issue is whether depreciation for real estate is correct in the first place, right? What's the level of decay in real estate, and whether straight lining of rents and straight lining of real estate without having a residual value that may be higher is associated with depreciating real estate. I think the issue is not leases. You're opening a broader discussion of how one would depreciate real estate in the first place in accounting. So putting this aside for a second, going back to Bill's earlier point, I think when you think about, whether straight line is the right attribute and whether users want to get the cash flow, absolutely user wants to get the cash flow, this is the nature of the economic arrangements. But if there's different significant shift, intra-period shifts in cost, probably users would like to see what the right economics in the deal would be, and the example that David made about putting the money up front or the back end will actually make a significant difference, because the nature of the transfer is the use of funds versus use of an asset, right? Those are meaningful distinctions as far as what the nature of the economic arrangement is. I also somewhat disagree with Bill that you end up with straight lining of rents, a straight line any way you get there, and I'll tell you why, because I think from an economic perspective, let's presume that leases are terminable at any given point, right? Putting aside, just keeping it quite simple, I would say that what a lessee compensates a lessor is for two things. One is for the lessor decay of the assets, right? There's some decay of the assets, real estate you may have lower than perhaps a vehicle, and the capital cost of tying the money, plus some margin, assuming it's a triple net lease and all the costs are being paid by the lessee. Those are the two elements that you compensate for. Depending on the nature of the decay of the assets or the capital cost, they're going to have meaningful distinction and not necessarily always going to be straight line. In some cases, they might be. So if you think about some long-term notions, I agree that you want to account for both the decay and the capital costs. In some cases, they're going to be straight line or closer to straight line. In some cases, they may not. And then the question is whether short-term leases, more service-oriented, less than 24 months, you want to call them service because, it's going to be a major bookkeeping toll with some disclosures. I'm not objecting to that, notwithstanding it may deviate from a concept, because it will allow you to sell the project and make it practicable for application.
Okay, thanks, Larry. Larry?
When Kristen first teed this up, she compared and contrasted two of the approaches that the staff has put forth. One is basically relying on IAS 17 and the considerations within that. The other one is more of a business model approach, which is trying to differentiate how one views the lease. And I guess when I go through it, I'm interested in what your views are as the operationality of some of the considerations in the business model approach, because when I look at it, at least my preliminary assessment is that some of them are going to be pretty difficult, because some of the concepts in there are whether the lease is really, you know, financing or has an element of financing in it, or whether the lease rental payments are being dictated mostly by market conditions, et cetera. And when I consider those, I say, well, all leases have some type of financing element. All leases are somewhat influenced by what the market is. So how are we going to operationalize those, and whether that's just a deep hole that we really don't want to go down?
Is this Rich or Ann?
It's Rich.
Okay, go ahead. You're going to answer Larry's question.
Well, I guess it kind of follows on my point. In my mind, this is a scope question. The scope question being, is it a finance lease or other than finance lease? And the one challenge I have with scope is when our clients don't know whether they're in the scope of a standard or not. So in this case, I think it's going to be very clear that either of these approaches, Larry, you will have different companies accounting for the identical transaction differently. And I'm okay with that, and I can live with that if the boards specifically acknowledge that that will be a consequence of this and that they expect that diversity in practice. Practically speaking, an individual company will take these principles and bring them down to things like percentages to implement them so that they know that identical transactions are accounted for the same. So, Larry, I guess in the way I'm answering your question, I cannot apply either one of these to say that the identical transaction will be accounted for the same on different companies, because the way both of them are written, reasonable companies at certain transactions will make judgments and treat them differently. And I think there will be a lot of diversity.
So let me follow up. Under which one do you think there'll be less diversity in practice?
Probably the IS 17. But the only reason is because a lot of people who apply IS 17 say we'll use percentages to apply it. Maybe we won't use 90%, we'll use 85%. And that's, quote, the difference between the principle and the rule.
Any other comments on this particular issue?
Here's your chance. Boards are going to be discussing it. Weibo?
That's a technical issue. Bill, you touched about uneven payment. How about impairment for the lessee?
I'm not sure that I know enough to answer that question. Because I think it's difficult for a lessee to determine if a leased asset is impaired. I do think if the leased asset is sitting idle, that's easy to say that it's impaired. But otherwise, I think it's very difficult. And I don't have an answer for it. In other words, if I have a truck and it's sitting idle and I still have to make the payments, I know that it's impaired, but if it's not generating the revenue that I expected, it's hard to identify revenue to specific assets in order to determine if the asset is impaired that I'm leasing. I guess I really should say I'm just not qualified to answer that question. Maybe someone else can.
Did you want to come in on the one, Daryl?
I think maybe to help Bill, I like what Bill said earlier, that to some degree, particularly with respect to the other than financing leases, maybe we need to decide whether our objective is to account for the obligation or to account for the underlying. And if we say on the other than financing leases that our primary objective is to account for the obligation, and we say that the asset, the right of use asset, would not exist but for that obligation being there with it, then that might go a long way as a principle towards helping answer the potential impairment question, because I think Bill's struggling about the impairment of the underlying, when really what we're talking about is the potential impairment of the right of use. I think it also would go a long way towards helping answer Paul's question about real estate. And does real estate depreciate over time? Well, maybe we don't need to be so worried about the underlying real estate as being the asset. I guess my point is, I'm asking the question of the group, on the other than financing leases, if we were to buy into the idea that really what we're trying to do is account for the obligation, then would simplification be the second objective that we would have after that? And by that I mean, do we really want to introduce the complexities of an annuity-based calculation, et cetera, or do we simply want to consider straight-lining the expense and having the other side of the entry be an adjustment to that asset that's on the balance sheet that wouldn't be there if we didn't put the obligation on there with it?
Okay. Anybody that wants to respond to that is welcome to. David?
Just on the question of impairment, I mean, I'm not quite sure why it's a problem. I mean, you could do the impairment the same way as any other impairment. Yes, you've got all the difficulties of identifying cash flows, but that's no different for a leased asset than an owned asset. But you still do an impairment. And you simply look at the future income, the present value of that, compared to the carrying amount. Why is that an issue if you use the annuity method as opposed to straight line? It's just more likely to be impaired if it's annuity than straight line.
I think that was the point of Wagwa's question. You'd expect there to be perhaps more circumstances where you'd reach a conclusion.
Yeah, I think under the proposed models in ED, you know, the liability equity assets will account for separately based on the principles we applied in anywhere. But now we want to use the annuity method, although the straight line being the expenses, and then the as you said, or we, most of us will agree, we should account for liability based on the normal or conventional principles, and then the make up the other part as a depreciation or amortization of the asset. And then, in any case, you know, company may face problems. The asset impaired, you know, not useful as you originally expected. Then should we account for impairment or not? If not, it's okay. You will always, you know, be apply the same principle. If you want to account for the impairment, then I'm not sure what's the remaining amount can be make up to the straight line. This is related to the fundamental question raised by Paul.
But why is that an issue? I mean, you measure impairment, usually the value in use by present value in the future cash flows, which is precisely how annuity benefit you value it anyway. It's more likely that under annuity method, the value of the asset will be closer to the value in use.
Okay, let's move on then. John?
Just a couple of observations. Going to Paul's question, I think that ultimately all depreciational amortization is cost allocation. It's not valuation. So all we're trying to do here is say that at the end of the day, we have a lease contract. What should be the total cost that's allocated with regards to that contract? And there's various ways you can get there at annuities. It's just one of those ways to do that. The second point, going back to the two models that are in the staff paper, as a practical matter, I think it gets to be hard to make a determination, I think as a lessor or even as a lessee, without referencing what you're paying back to the value of the underlying. Now, there's problems because this is not an underlying-based model, but that's always the anchor that you kind of bring things back to at all times. So that's kind of a short plea for, you know, probably some comparison to what is being paid versus what the value is of value is of relevance.
Thank you. Kevin?
I'm just intrigued on this impairment question because I was sitting looking on the page, again, in my industry. Let's assume I have got a lease, and I have capitalized it, and it consists of 10 trucks. I was looking at the contract as my component because to try and sub-element the contract into each one of those individual 10 trucks for which truck did I now idle is a nightmare because the contract's not priced in that format. So if the contract as a whole would be impaired if it became onerous, but I can't see how the one truck example within an overall contract could cause an impairment.
Is that any different from if you own 10 trucks and you've got some idle capacity, which one do you impair?
Yeah. I look at
it's
the
not
onerous,
a leasing issue, it's an impairment issue.
Yeah, I look at the onerous contract argument, not a...
I think you're actually in what you call a cash-generating unit.
Yes, and I think the whole contract is
David's point, you know, maybe if you're just talking about sort of a large item, maybe it's a plane or something, I don't know, but you've got to apply the impairment rules depending on the circumstances you face, and in your case, you are probably into a much larger cash-generating unit.
Yeah, that's what I said. I'm not looking at a to componentise the contract.
Paul?
I wanted to ask about the issue of offsetting and use of a definition of a liability and asset in our conceptual framework. The arguments I've heard for annuity depreciation and other arguments around the table are really to look at the net contract position. We relate the asset and the liability, and that's how we get to annuity depreciation because we say, well, we want straight line. I think that's what you're doing, David.
If you're doing it if an owned asset, you have no liability, or it may be separate. You don't need to have a liability in order to apply the annuity method of depreciation.
Looking at
the cash flows from the asset.
But we do not offset assets and liabilities. We account for them separately, and they're separately defined in our framework. In the lease, though, I think you're proposing to account for the net contract liability.
I'm not, no.
Okay, go ahead.
That's a misunderstanding. I'm saying you account for the two separately, not netting at all. I'm saying you account for the asset on the annuity method, and I'm saying you should apply exactly the same principle to an owned asset. I'm not saying it's because it's a lease or anything else. I'm saying an annuity method of depreciation is a valid method of depreciation
for
all assets.
But why is that? You argued that that's because the cost of owning an asset over its life is even.
No, I didn't.
Others did, for sure.
Yes, I never did. I'm simply looking at what use of that asset have I consumed in the period.
Yes.
And I would say the value in use at the beginning compared to the value in use at the end is a measure of the consumption of that asset over that period.
And that could be going up or down.
It could be going any direction. But sure. I'm saying that is a measure of the use in that period. And it's not necessarily straight line any more than the value in use declines on a straight line basis.
But what we say in IAS 16 and what we said in the exposure draft is you measure the consumption of an asset based on consumption of the amortization based on consumption of benefits.
But at the moment, the accounting
is no more correct than straight line of the years did.
But at the moment, the annuity method is not allowed. None of the accounting firms will allow anyone to use the annuity method of depreciation. I'm saying it should be allowed under the principles of IAS 16. It's an arbitrary prohibition.
But do you start from the principle that the amortization should reflect the consumption of benefits?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he's just simply saying it's a value-based depreciation methodology, which is discounted cash flows. And one of the reasons why the accounting firms may well take that view is... because we did have a prohibition against inverse sum of the year's digits, and there was some egregious practices in the past, and there's all sorts of history and baggage associated with this. But I think we understand your point, David. You're saying it should be generally applied
not just in the context of leases. Yeah. Bill, do you want to come in?
I just wanted to make a comment or talk further about what Paul is talking about. I do think we're accounting for the contract, and the board has rightfully said that the best proxy seems to be to value that contract to present value the obligation at the, let's say, the lessee's incremental borrowing rate, because we have a hard time trying to figure out what the value of the asset is if you look at the right to use. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not advocating netting, but I am saying that if the lease was a good deal and the asset is still being used, why isn't the value of that contract the same on the asset and liability side for the life of that contract? Doesn't it hold true that in the second month, the value of the asset is the present value of the future obligations? Same as the 30th month. Why isn't the value of the asset the same? That is the present value of the remaining lease payments.
So you advocate the linked
approach. I'm saying it's linked, but it's still recorded as an asset and liability.
But that assumes flat rentals. If I want to lease this floor of this building, but I have surplus cash, the only way I can obtain this building is through a lease because I can't get the freehold on a floor. But I don't. If I got surplus cash, I don't want to pay rentals each month. So I prepay the full amount. Therefore, my obligation on day one is zero. But you're saying my right of use asset is also zero.
No, in that case, I just amortize the right of use straight line. And if I pay the rents all at the end, my idea is that I'm going to accrue that liability because I'm going to accrue the average rent. So I'm going to build up a liability on my books because I'm paying that at the end. So I think it's not just amortization of the asset and liability. It's accounting for the rents on an accrual basis. I would also like to make one other comment, that what we call the lease cost is important for cost reimbursement. So it's not just how we amortize the asset and how we account for the imputed cost of the financing, but it's what do we call it, because there are lots of business situations where companies are only reimbursed for rent expense under current GAAP.
Okay, lots of lights flashing, and if we don't get through them, you'll be late for lunch, so let's hear from you. George?
I would just like to acknowledge the boards and the staff for finally focusing on a non-finance lease. With respect to real estate, we've been saying this for 3 years now, that the lease of this floor of a retail space is not a financing. And I think you all have done a terrific job with respect to the other than finance lease. I think some of the criteria is right on. With respect to depreciation or amortization, Paul, I go way back with this one. We've been trying to fix depreciation of investment property for at least 30 years. It's probably beyond the scope of this project, but about 15 years ago, we suggested that simply, I'm going to say the auditors, I shouldn't blame it on the auditors, that we be allowed to use a realistic salvage value or residual value in the calculation. And in many, many cases, that would produce the consumption of the benefit or the value or the utility of the property. But it would certainly, for an investment property, be a better measurement of depreciation or use, value used or utility used, than straight line or anything else we use today. So that's probably beyond the scope of this project. But I think you're on to I think your other than finance lease is what we've been looking for. So thank you.
We should have put you on last for that comment. But, George, well, we've got your answers in IFRS, because in IS16 we have actually addressed that residual value issue with the improvements, and you've got to look at it each period, and it's value-based. But if you're not happy with that, we can give you IS40 and you can just fair value.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to say, IS40. But IAS16, the problem with IAS16, you can revalue the asset, and then you use that higher value to depreciate.
Yeah, and I was
straight line basis.
Yeah, no, I was talking about the residual value, and we did address that.
It comes back to some whoever made this point before, Neri or someone, I can't remember. But John, you want to come in, and then I think we'll break for lunch if we can.
Well, back to your point before, I view that as like the second question. Before that, there's a lease contract, and the boards have determined that the contract should be broken into components. My question is, what's the theory behind breaking into the components first, and then we can get back to the question, well, what lies the right contract together? And I think when are contracts broken apart is one of the great questions of the accounting literature, right?
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Bill?
I would ask Warren if I could make one comment on renewals, although it's not on the agenda, but I wanted to make one comment. I would hope that the boards would consider renewals or extensions as new leases and use the concepts that they've, or the concept that they've tentatively concluded on, and that is you don't account for the lease when you sign it, you account for it when it commences. If you use that same concept with accounting for renewals, it will vastly simplify accounting for lessees, because a retailer could renew a lease, could negotiate an extension, or could decide to lease a place across the street. And I think leasing the place across the street, they wouldn't account for that. But the way the thinking seems to be that if I sign an extension, I'm going to automatically start to account for that now. And if that extension has higher rents, I'm going to start to account for the P&L now. So I think just looking at the practical application of where the decisions are on renewals, I think it would be much simpler if we accounted for a renewal or an extension as a new lease.
Okay. You slipped that one in, but that's fine. So let's break now, and we'll come back at 1 o'clock. Thanks very much.